And I am very happy today to bring two special guests on the air with us. I have Sreta Santis and Hillary Martin. Sra is a 28-year-old organic vegetable farmer in Burlington's Intervale with the Diggers Mirth Collective Farm. She works with the Institute of Social Ecology's Biotech Project, which takes her throughout Vermont as well as Central America to work against genetically engineered crops. She is a member of Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine and Israel. And also with me is Hillary Martin.
Ah!
Anyway, Hillary Martin is a 27-year-old vegetable farmer who is also with the Diggers Mirth Collective Farm. She is a member of the Free Radio Burlington Collective and Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine and Israel. And we welcome both of you to the Quilting Hour.
Thanks so much for having us. It's great to be here.
It's my pleasure. And Hillary, I saw you last month on April 17th for the Via Campesina International Day of Farmer Solidarity.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, you almost didn't have a voice.
I think I had talked about Palestine so much that I lost it. I lost my voice.
The worthy cause to lose your voice over.
Yeah.
So you're giving your voice over to the cause. And both of you just returned last month from a month in Palestine, is that correct?
This is Hillary. I was there for 1 month, but Sarah was there for about 2.5 months, January, February, and part of March, right, Sarah?
Wow. And since you've been back, now, were you both in Gaza primarily?
This is Sarah. No internationals right now can actually get into Gaza. It's really hard for internationals to get into Gaza because of the restrictions. And you hear about the wall that's being built in the West Bank, but Gaza already has a wall around it. And at that point, no internationals except for a few press and really high-level official NGOs were able to get in, so we never got into Gaza.
In fact, there are formally restrictions on anybody entering any internationals entering, or is, you know, including Israelis entering the Palestinian territories at all. It's strictly enforced in Gaza, but not mm-hmm. so much in the West Bank. And so that's where, yeah, we ended up spending all of our time was just in the West Bank.
In the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, I know I've heard Starhawk has been extensively in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And the last news I heard, I guess, was from an Israeli journalist who has been in Gaza for years and years, and basically they accept her mm-hmm. as almost one
Amir
of
Haas.
Amir Haas. Yes.
She spent years in Gaza but is now living in the West Bank in Ramallah.
In Ramallah?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. She just came out with a new book about her. I think it's been a couple years that she's been in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was featured on Democracy Now! Yesterday.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
You should check it out.
Yes, yeah. Amy was interviewing her and basically getting more inside information on what's going on in Gaza right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I guess, blogs of different people in Gaza who are managing to get information out on the horrors.
Yeah, yep.
Unfortunately, I think now anyone who's listening heard that they're now calling this incursion into Rafah and Zaytun basically worse than the 1967 war.
Mm, yeah, I was reading yesterday about how, what was it, about almost 1,000 Palestinians have been displaced because of home demolitions in the past year,
yeah.
And about 11,000 since the Intifada started in 2000, 11,000 mm-hmm. people just in Rafah.
Out of 11,000 out of 90,000, which is the population of Rafah, have been displaced because of house demolitions. And I actually heard yesterday on NPR, National Public Radio, an Israeli official getting on the radio, and he actually stated that they're not demolishing houses. What they're doing is getting rid of the arms trafficking corridor between Egypt
and Gaza. So they're actually, he's actually denying that these house demolitions are going on. And there's several dozens and dozens more scheduled for the next few days.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're talking about basically people taking window frames, windows, couches. They're taking everything out of their houses in order, in advance of this. But you know, they're talking now. The Israelis are talking about supposed what do you call it? Tunnels?
The tunnels.
The tunnels. Supposed tunnels over to Egypt, and they're smuggling arms. But I think it's fairly clear that they're just creating a whole swath, you know, and basically no person's land. Around the Gaza, and
what they called transforming the border, I think is how it was put.
The doublespeak is wonderful,
right? Yeah, and it's and like the example that Sarah just gave, it's entirely negated or denied in the press or in the sort of rhetoric of the government and the military. All of what's really happening on the ground is completely ignored, you know, in the name of security. You know, which is happening in Gaza, it's happening through the West Bank, it's happening in Iraq, it's happening in our own country, right? It's like, the lack of freedoms and civil liberties in the name of security. And, you know, we are starting to see bits of it through, you know, the Patriot Act here in this country, but the level of which that it affects Palestinians' lives is just totally mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say a couple of things about house demolitions, if that's okay?
Please.
Right now, there's more house demolitions going on than any other time in during the Second Intifada. And hopefully people have been hearing about this in the news. But this is even more than when they were demolishing houses. I think it was 2002 in Nablus and Jenin. And it's off the record how many houses are being demolished. And when you talk about a house demolition, Hillary puts this really well. I don't know. I'll try to rephrase it. But, you know, when a Palestinian buys a house, it's not like in the United States where you take out a mortgage. They put their whole life earnings, their life saving, their family's life savings that they've been, you know, money that they've been building up for generations to buy a house. And, you know, usually in houses, several generations will live in a house in separate apartments. So you're not just destroying the house of one individual family. You're really destroying houses of extended families.
Mm-hmm.
And where do they go? The UN's setting up camps right now, tent camps. But everything that a Palestinian owns is inside their house. And now that those houses are in rubble.
Well, and if I could just interject, like when we were in Bethlehem, we went to the Aida refugee camp and witnessed two homes were demolished when we were there in a period of about 4 days. And so in that case, as well as in the case in Rafah in Gaza, we're talking about homes that are in refugee camps that were set up in 1948 as tents, and slowly, like Sarah said, families invested everything that they had to build a structure, to build a home. And that's being demolished. You know, refugees twice over now are being made.
Yeah.
Again, in the name of security, no evidence needed, no trial.
No.
You know, that's how justice works in the occupied territories. That's what justice is under an occupation.
And I think I've seen pictures, but these bulldozers, any bulldozers that you see in the United States, it doesn't even come close to these bulldozers. These are machines of destruction, built for destruction. They're armored, monstrous.
They're made by Caterpillar, too. They're specially made by Caterpillar, a U.S. company that has contracts with the Israeli government to make specialized house demolition bulldozers. So they're coming from the United States.
Part of your $3 billion tax dollars that go to the Israeli government.
$14 million a day in military aid goes from U.S. tax dollars to the Israeli military budget.
Which, you know, on top of that military aid that's given from the U.S. government to Israel, on top of that, there are millions of dollars of military contracts that Israel secures with U.S. corporations. So it's oftentimes U.S. dollars funneled into the Israeli government, which then goes straight back to the United States corporations.
Yes.
With contracts, yeah.
Yeah. For the military-industrial complex and of our favorite friends of Halliburton and
yes.
General Dynamics, General Electric.
General Electric, General
Boeing.
Dynamics. Boeing. Jeez, and these are some of the underwriters of NPR.
Yes. I wonder if that has to do with the kind of news that we're getting about how home demolitions aren't actually happening.
Yeah. Aren't actually
on NPR.
Happening.
I heard that yesterday.
Yes. I get just my personal thing is that during the actual war that ended last year, so to speak, in Iraq, NPR sounded like it was coming directly from the White House. And at that point, I decided I was not listening to NPR anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been an NPR listener since childhood, and just I couldn't believe the unblinking adherence to the Bush line during that time.
I just like listening to NPR so I know what they're actually saying, like getting this information and be able to talk about it, that, you know, there are Israeli officials that are out there saying house demolitions aren't happening in Rafah, where it's all over the news and it's obvious that it's happening. And, yeah, we have to be able to debate both, you know,
yes.
on both
sides of the issue. And I know, you know,
not that I'm a sponsor or a supporter of NPR, but it's good to know what they're saying so you can actually respond to it, I think.
It's similar to those, you know, who say the Holocaust never existed.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But our one of the major things I wanted to talk about today is looking at women's issues in Palestine, because I know we can go on and on about the hideous stuff that's going on in Palestine, but the women are, of course, inextricably bound up with that, especially I know. I'll start speaking with my personal experience because I've been in Palestine, I was in Israel, and I've been in Jordan, and of course Jordan is a country, I think something like 75% are Palestinians, or it's a large percentage.
It's like around 50%.
50%. But the homes are literally, I'd say even more so than in the U.S., it seems like they're castles. They don't put their work into the suburbanite dream of nicely manicured lawns and everything else. All of their work goes inside the home. It's a work of beauty.
Very much so.
Inside the homes. And that's, you know, people see Islam, and they think of women's being shut inside, but the home is the woman's domain.
That's right. Yeah, because we were talking about home demolitions and refugee camps. One thing that Sarah and I like to point out is that, obviously, you know, we hear a lot about Palestinians as terrorists in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And what we don't hear about is really what's becoming a tradition of nonviolent resistance. And I say tradition because it's been 37 plus years, or 50 years if you want to count from 1948. There's really this kind of tradition of nonviolent resistance to occupation and resistance to effectively what is an attempt to wipe out, if not a whole population of people, a whole culture. What is Palestinian culture? One way that resistance manifests itself is through building these beautiful, beautiful homes, constructing a three-story home that will house three generations of people. Mm-hmm. And they're really just beautiful places, and it really says, I'm proud to be Palestinian, I'm proud to be here, I will build my family and my home here, regardless of what you say are my rights.
Yes. Can you talk? I'm sure you've been in many Palestinian homes while you were out there. Can you tell us a little bit what your experience is with families, with the women in Palestine?
Ahlan wa sahlan.
Ahlan bik.
Ahlan biki. Well, you know. That means, well, you know, well, it actually means you are with our land, you are with our people. When they say ahlan wa sahlan, but we say it as like, welcome to our house.
Yes.
I think that expression really embodies what the culture takes on, that you are welcome here on our land, you are welcome here with our people. This house basically is your house. And when you step foot into a Palestinian home, you're served tea and coffee and cookies, and the hospitality is so overwhelming and you feel so comfortable. And it's very different from our culture, obviously, because it's somewhat gender divided. And, you know, we'll go hang out with the women and men will go hang out with the men. But the women, even though they might not be inside the meetings, they do have a very large power, a position of power, like you were saying. Their domain is the house. And in the house, many decisions are made. But it's really endearing to go sit with elderly women all the way from, you know, 90 years old down to the little babies, and seeing all the generations, four or five generations of one family sitting in a room, and discussing the day, discussing what needs to be done. It's beautiful.
You know, you don't have this nuclear family compartmentalization of grandparents off someplace else. No, the parents here, the children are off doing something else.
Right. This one family that I became really, really close with in Budrus, which is a village almost on the Green Line, the 1967 border between the West Bank and Israel. And there, right now, the wall, the apartheid wall, which Israel dubs as the security perimeter, is being built right in their olive groves. Mm. And this one family has been really the leaders in the village, leading the resistance against the construction of the wall. And, you know, three of the women in this family had their husbands in jail. Mm. This one woman had two brothers and two sons in jail, and because they, no, three brothers, excuse me, three brothers and two sons, because they were nonviolently resisting the wall. One of her brothers was put in jail because he was housing internationals and speaking on a loudspeaker. So you see a lot of men and women being in prison, but a lot more men. Of course, during the first Intifada, almost all men of age were arrested, and this is still happening. People that are demonstrating nonviolently are being incarcerated, and then the woman is left with her family and having to take care of not only the family but her husband's. You know, this family in particular had a really leadership role in the community, so that these women having to take on some of that and still having to host, you know, discussions and what are we going to do next? You know, if the Israeli soldiers come in and this kind of thing.
Mm. It was, yeah, I wanted to say that it was really, I feel so lucky and honored that Sarah and I had extended time in places like Budrus. Because Palestinians opened their homes to us so many times.
Yes, they do.
Really only if we had, an afternoon or a day or a week or 2.5 months, you know, to spend there, did we have the opportunity to speak to the women? Because, you know, when you're invited to a home, you sit in the living room and you have tea, but the women are in the kitchen. And as women, internationals, we had this kind of privilege to be able to sit with the men and discuss, you know, politics and discuss strategies for resisting occupation. And then we had the privilege of being able to go deep into the home and talk with women and hang out with the kids. And there we found really, really what it was like to struggle through an occupation. You know, we were with women as they were crying with joy when their brother was released from prison. Mm. You know, we got to play with the little kids. You know, we we would hear the kids as they would say, in Arabic, I don't remember the word, but they would say curfew, you know.
One of the first words they learn in their vocabulary is jesh, soldier, or curfew, you know. I mean, all these words, that's...
Wow.
How, I mean, just think about the psychology of the children.
And and being able to be kind of in the fold, if you will, of the home, you know, we could really see how it's more than organizing a demonstration. It's more than like, oh, I can't get through this checkpoint to go to work. It's the emotional and psychological effects that it has on the kids, and that the women really carry, because they are caring for their entire family. Which, you know, I think went a long way in terms of really touching our hearts, and really fueling us to do the kind of work that we're trying to do here back home in Vermont. Because those stories and those sentiments, that passion, you know, has really stayed with us. And that's, you know, what we got from the women that we met and became very close with.
And I always try to make sure people understand that now Palestinians becomes this umbrella term, and people don't realize that Palestinians are Christians more often than not than Muslims. But that there is a large Christian Palestinian contingent out there.
That's especially around the Bethlehem area is where I think in Hebron area, there are large Christian, Palestinian populations, but the vast majority are Muslim, but there are Christian.
And say, but more so than in any other part of the Arab world.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
No, except for Egypt. No, they've got a significant Christian subpopulation. And so I think just that people tend to paint a brush and think that, you know, all Palestinians are Muslim is not so true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think just making the statement that Palestine exists is a huge statement. I mean, the other day we had a vigil in Burlington. We have one once a month, the Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine, Israel. And one man yelled us, there's no place called Palestine. And, you know, that's something that we should talk about a little bit, because historically Palestine, what is now what is all of Israel, and what is Gaza and the West Bank. And what Palestine is today is just Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which is 22% of the original land mass that Palestinians were able to live on.
Right.
And this whole area is about the size of Vermont. So just to put it in perspective of what a small area. And then, of course, there's a huge diaspora of 4 million Palestinians that are refugees. Well, not just refugees, but also have made it outside of Palestine. So, yeah, just to say Palestine is a place, it's a very political statement.
Yeah. Well, I just read on this show 2 weeks ago that there was yet another UN resolution that I don't think I heard in the news anywhere else, that the UN passed a resolution stating, you know, that Palestine needs to be granted statehood.
Has the right to exist.
Has the right to exist, and the Palestinians should not be transferred, which is the many of the hardliners' euphemisms for basically wiping them all out of Palestine and moving them into the sea.
Well, it's, you know, right now what's happening with the construction of the wall and with the continued occupation. I mean, in the occupation, I mean checkpoints, I mean daily arrests, murders. Yeah, literally waiting at a checkpoint, you could be waiting there an hour, you could be waiting there 9 hours. And it's total frustration and humiliation. And now that the wall's being constructed, whole cities, Qalqilya, a city of 42,000, is completely surrounded by the wall now.
People can't even get to their farms, isn't that right?
Yeah, get to their farms or get to hospitals or get to their jobs in Ramallah or wherever. And what's happening is there's been a immigration push, urban immigration, you know, into the cities. And the countryside is going to be left you know, without Palestinians, because they can't get to their agricultural lands. And there's actually a law in Israel that states if Palestinian land is left uncultivated for 3 years, that Israel can legally annex it. So the wall is essentially doing this. Like, farmers can't get to their olive trees. They can't get to their citrus groves. And supposedly this land will be able to be legally annexed in 3 years by Israel, although it's already happening illegally. I mean, that's essentially what's happening with the wall.
If their olive groves and citrus groves haven't been plowed under.
Yeah, that's right. If they haven't been demolished to make way for the wall, which is, just to give some perspective, if we remember the Berlin Wall, that was about 8 feet tall and about 100 kilometers long. Right. The proposed path of the apartheid wall, in contrast, will be 400 kilometers long. Mm. In places, it's a 26-foot high concrete wall.
26. I was thinking 22, 26. Wow. That's a three-story building.
Yeah, exactly. In other cases, it's an electric fence. Like, that's about, I think it's about 8 feet tall. And one of the reasons, apart from the length, that the wall is causing so much destruction in its path, is that it's actually about 150 feet wide. Because not only is it a wall, but on both sides, it's bordered by a trench and razor wire and a military patrol roads. That is like a security perimeter for the security perimeter itself. The patrol road and the razor wire are dotted with signs that say danger, military zone, anyone who attempts to damage this fence is endangering his life. So it's not only is it a formal kind of annexation of more land, but it's also a justification for more violence and militarization.
Saying, more settlements.
Here's a line, and if you cross it, you will be shot, essentially.
And I think if you have heard about this, the so-called security perimeter or security barrier, which I want to talk about in a second, why that name is completely wrong or misleading. But most people think that it's an actual line, that it follows the green line, the border between the West Bank and Israel. And in fact, it goes deep into Palestinian territory. Almost the whole thing is off the green line. And it's actually taking large chunks of land and giving it basically to annexing it. To Israeli settlements, which are illegal under international law, and Israel itself. But there are also about 10 places that will become enclaves, completely encircled. The first one has already been built, which is Qalqiyah, which I mentioned before. But this is going to basically make all these non-contiguous areas where Palestinians are allowed to live.
So it's cantonizing. It's basically turning
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to mention the name security perimeter. I mean, if you're going to build something for security, which Israel should be concerned about suicide bombings, because unfortunately, I mean, I'm sure none of, you know, I don't agree with suicide bombings, and I'm sure most of the people listening hopefully don't agree with suicide bombings. So there is a security issue that Israel has to worry about. I personally think that if the occupation ended and settlements were moved, that there wouldn't be any more suicide bombings. But, if we're just talking about the security perimeter from the point of security, it should be built on the green line on Israeli soil, not on Palestinian land. If you were going to build a fence on your yard, you wouldn't build it on your neighbor's land. That would be considered illegal because it's not your property. And Israel is going deep inside the West Bank. So a lot of us don't really think that it's a perimeter for security, but it's really a perimeter for land confiscation, and that's literally what it's doing every single day.
Yeah, well, the farmers, basically, it's telling that, well, the root of it is that it's telling them they have no right to expect land, they have no right to expect any life outside of what the Israelis say that they can have. And that I just feel like it, now there are echoes of the ghettoization that happened 50 years ago in Poland, in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah.
During this, before the Second World War. And these people are being corralled, literally, into smaller and smaller areas where the conditions are becoming more and more intolerable. Basically concentration camps.
Yeah. And it's in the past 10 years, since about 1994, when the Oslo Accords were passed, you know, there was a lot of hope, especially within the territories, that power was going to be transferred gradually to the Palestinians. And what's really happened instead is tightening of security measures, quote unquote. Dozens, literally, there used to be two checkpoints in all of the territories, one that led into Jerusalem and one into Gaza. Now there are about the number fluctuates, but there are about 67 permanent permanent checkpoints as of, you know, December, I think it was.
January, there was 59, according to the
UN. Right. So, you know, this number literally changes every month, the number of checkpoints. There are roving checkpoints. There are roadblocks, trenches, there are gates. You know, all of these sorts of measures have really tightened in the past 10 years. And so even with just the checkpoints, the sort of restriction of movement that exists on the ground already. I'll tell you a story. We visited a village called Deir Balut, and it's about 4,000 people live there. And there's a checkpoint just outside of the village at the crossroads. We were told that a woman, before we had been there, a woman was trying to leave Deir Balut to get to Ramallah. She was in labor. There's no hospital in Deir Balut. So she was going to Ramallah to get to the hospital to give birth. She was not allowed passage through the checkpoint. And so she went into labor directly, just right in front of the checkpoint. And the Israeli soldiers watched her as she was on the ground. They actually lifted her skirt up, and, you know, there was direct harassment going on as she was in labor. She gave birth to twins, and an hour later, those twins died. So this is what's happening on the ground in the territories. And now there's a wall being constructed. Deir Balut is one of 8 villages that will be encircled together in one of those cantons or enclaves. You know, Deir Balut and 8 other villages will be completely surrounded with one gate. That gate will be opened in 1 hour in the morning, for an hour in the middle of the day, and an hour in the evening. That's assuming, you know, the gate will be open, assuming the soldiers feel like it. You know, if there's not a holiday, for example, where the soldiers are going to stay home and be with their families. You know, assuming the soldiers will be in a good mood and allow everybody to pass. Deir Balut and the other villages within that future enclave, none of them have hospitals. There are no universities. The only jobs are at the schools, you know, or at the few, you know, handful of little shops, you know, which are, they're staffed by the people who own them.
Well, I've heard university students, they can't go to school, you know, even in Gaza, you know, they can't. To get to the university, Gaza's now been basically partitioned into 3 parts. And I was just thinking to myself, okay, I drove here from Montpelier. You know, that's about 13 miles. And thinking about, you know, I did that journey in probably, oh, let's say 17 minutes. I'm probably talking about, you know, maybe hours and hours.
It would probably be about a 3-hour
depending on how many checkpoints are officially set up, how many roving checkpoints there are, how long you're going to have to wait at the checkpoint. I just want to mention one thing about Deir Balut is that the 98% of this village's land is going to be confiscated by the wall when it's completed there. That's all of their agricultural land, their wheat fields, their grazing land, their olive groves. So that's that's just one example of one village, how much land they're going to be losing. I visited another village called Nailin, which is right next to Budras, and they will be completely, another enclave, completely encircled by the fence. And again, no hospitals, no clinics, no, you know, universities. And while I was there, we were at this demonstration. It was nonviolent demonstration, and it was on a Friday, and it was a Muslim village, so they decided, the men decided to have prayer in the olive grove instead of in the mosque, because the Israeli contractors were cutting trees, the olive groves. And as soon as they got up, you know, stood up from prayer, there was a rain of rubber bullets and tear gas and sound bombs from the Israeli soldiers. And when you looked behind, you saw that these olive trees were being cut limb by limb, 200-year-old olive trees. And what was going to happen was that they should have just demolished them. They weren't even going to demolish them. They were actually uprooting these trees and selling them to the neighboring Israeli settlement. So olive trees that are 200 years old that have been in Palestinian hands for generations are now being sold to settlements. Illegal settlements.
They're not being sold, they're being stolen.
Stolen, exactly. But there's the Israeli government's taking that and taking all the money from the sale, the illegal sale of these trees. Exactly. And of course, Palestinians get, when their house is demolished, when they lose their agricultural land, there's no compensation.
No reparations.
No, nothing.
Right. I wanted to just get back to the point that I was making earlier, that. You know, we could sort of go on and on and on and on and on, describing the kinds of difficulties that Palestinians faced before 2003 when the wall started to be built.
2002.
Thank you, 2002. And I think when, you know, because I think we should address suicide bombings because it's a part of this conflict. The suicide bombings increased since 1994, significantly in the past few years.
Incredibly, yes.
The suicide bombings are a symptom.
Exactly.
They're a symptom of the occupation, and the reason why they have increased is not because Palestinians you know, have decided that they hate Israelis more in the past 3 years. Palestinians are responding directly, or, you know, and I want to say just a small handful really, of Palestinians are responding directly to that kind of tightening. And so I'm not sure what Israel is really expecting. I'm not really sure how they're expecting more security when they're going to completely seal off whole areas. You know, how do they expect a peaceful end when they're really aggravating the situation more by completely cutting people off, increasing the kind of frustration, powerlessness,
hopelessness. I mean, that's what suicide bombing, it's a symptom of basically total lack, a loss of hope, a loss of hope of any positive change. And, you know, so when you have nothing left to lose.
Just think, your family's been imprisoned. You may have had your house demolished, or you may have had someone in your family that's been killed. You have to wait. You lost your job because you can't get to work because of checkpoints. And then you lose all your land because of the wall. I mean, again, I don't agree with suicide bombings, but I see exactly how a suicide bomber is created.
Right.
And until, like I said before, until the occupation ends, until the settlements are removed, until East Jerusalem is allowed to be the capital of Palestine, unfortunately, these suicide bombings are going to continue and target. I mean, the Israeli government is doing so-called targeted killings all the time, daily.
Yes.
And they're not just, I mean, when they were in Rafah, a sniper shot a brother and sister that were hanging laundry on the roof. One of them was 9 years old. Is that
targeted,
a targeted killing? A targeted killing of children.
Right. Yes.
Right. And it's again, I would like to say that, hopefully if all of these things happened to me, I wouldn't choose to strap a bomb on myself. But I think when we're talking, if the state of Israel is trying to address suicide bombing, if they're trying to address terrorism, if that's really their true motivation,
then
why don't we look at why suicide bombings are happening? and try to understand, because we all know that if you build a barrier, there are other means, you know, things are just going to happen. And to solve a problem, we look at what's creating the problem, you know, not at, you know, creating another situation that it's just going to move around. And I really think it's important. I know, I'm sure there are people that are listening that will become angry. You know, they will say, you know, suicide bombing is never justified. And that's not what we're doing here. We're not trying to justify suicide bombings at all, but we're saying,
I don't think they're justified.
What is really, truly the source of the problem? And really, you know, I feel like from what we heard, from what people told us, and from how people were reacting, the wall will not prevent suicide bombings. And I really fear, honestly, I really feel that what could happen is that those suicide bombings intensify in response to the wall.
Can I say something also about this theme? Because, you know, I was in Palestine, I was in the West Bank for 2.5 months, and I actually only met two Palestinians that agreed with suicide bombings. And there is a huge movement that's existed for over a century that is nonviolent. Okay. And we're not just talking about nonviolent demonstrations. And of course, you know, from the corporate media here, most people think that all Palestinians are terrorists or all support suicide bombing.
Yes.
And the case is that that's not what I experienced at all. And, you know, it's not just nonviolent demonstrations that happen every single day against the occupation and against the construction of the wall, but it's mundane acts. You know, people are sneaking to their agricultural fields around checkpoints, around illegal Israeli settlements, so they can go harvest cucumbers or olives to put on their dinner table. Mm-hmm. They're literally cutting razor wire that's been laid right in the middle of their farm road so that they can get to their fields. You know, they're cutting gates on the wall and the fence so that they can cross it to get to their fields that they're no longer allowed to go to. And these are daily things that are nonviolent, that it's a form of resistance that we don't hear about. And the mere fact that they Palestinians continue to cultivate their lands is the most beautiful act of nonviolent resistance that I see. And I just want to really stress that the majority of Palestinians, the vast, vast majority, are committed to fighting nonviolently. In Budrus, the village we stayed in, they have nonviolent demonstrations on a regular basis. And there's villages all over the West Bank calling this Budrus, because they've actually gotten some international attention, saying, how can we have a struggle just like yours that's nonviolent? Because we don't want to put any Palestinians in danger. You know, they don't want to hurt Israelis. They just want their land. They want to live in peace. And this is, you know, something, of course, that doesn't get reported in the media here.
And I think what's also not reported as much is that there is an increasing number of Israelis who are also in solidarity with the Palestinians, are starting a nonviolent movement on their side to reverse apartheid. Apartheid. How do I say? The word doesn't even describe what's going on. It's it's so much worse than that.
Yeah. It's we had the pleasure, really, of working. Sarah and I were working with the International Solidarity Movement when we were there, which, for those who don't know of it, it's a Palestinian-led movement which facilitates internationals coming into the Palestinian territories and joining the struggle for Palestinian self-determination. And that's done through participating, as we did, in nonviolent demonstrations. It's done through international observation work, like watching checkpoints. It's done through accompanying Palestinians, whether it's through a checkpoint or staying with them in a home that could be demolished. And the main, or one of the main tenets held by the International Solidarity Movement is nonviolence. And we, with the International Solidarity Movement, worked with a whole handful of Israeli peace groups, and that included the Rabbis for Human Rights, which they were giving literally hundreds and hundreds. They gave 500 olive trees to the village of Budrus alone. And we're planting olive trees throughout the West Bank, which I think is such a beautiful symbol because it says, you know, we're giving an olive tree to your village because olive trees have been systematically destroyed. You know, it's saying not only are we against the occupation, but, you know, I think a gift of an olive tree, which really sort of symbolizes Palestinian culture, is saying we resist the occupation and we also affirm Palestinian culture, the right to be Palestinian.
Yeah.
So in addition to Rabbis for Human Rights, there's Gush Shalom, Anarchists Against the Wall, Tayush.
Maxam Watch, which does checkpoint observation at all the checkpoints with lots of cute little old Israeli women confronting the Israeli soldiers.
Right. And all of these are so, it's so courageous, you know, for Israelis to step out. Oftentimes, it means alienation from their own communities because they are interpreted as being anti-Israeli.
Sort of like here in the United States, we're considered as anti-American if we're participating in dissent.
Yes.
Exactly.
When really, you know, a lot of those Israelis are committed to the peace movement because they believe fighting for Palestinian self-determination means fighting for a stronger Israel, means a peaceful Israel is a stronger Israel.
That's right.
I so much admire Israelis who are able to step out of their privilege and their security. And they're, in a lot of cases, actually really endangering their lives. There was an Israeli shot at a nonviolent demonstration just before we got to the West Bank. And the soldier who shot him apologized later, saying, "I would never have shot had I known he was Israeli." Actually, I think he said, "Had I known he was a Jew," is what the soldier said.
I think he said, I thought he was Palestinian, actually. I don't know what it was, but it was, whatever, it was a very racist.
Very racist. Well, and the, you know, the racism just is reeking here. And earlier, I was couldn't help but thinking, you know, you have all these women who are living at home without men because the men have all been imprisoned. And I couldn't help but thinking it's like life in our inner cities here in the United States.
Very much.
You know, the same kind of apartheid, dare we say. But the system in the United States, you know, not official system, but how so many African-American families are being raised by women, and the women are having to carry on the traditions and carry on, you know, leading the homes and being the center of the homes.
Right.
You know, and I was thinking also that your story about the woman who gave birth, and it's not the first story I've heard that no woman basically going into labor, can't get to the hospital, giving birth at the checkpoint, and wondering, do they have any kind of system like of midwifery out there in Palestine?
Yes, but it seemed to me that women were preferring to go to the hospital, but there are some midwives still. I didn't really... I met one midwife, but it's, you know, people are wanting to get... It seemed like most women were wanting to go to a hospital to give birth.
It's, you know, I think it's not unlike many other situations, in the world where not only is Palestine facing the pressure of an occupation, but it's also facing the pressure of development and all of the sort of complex issues that that leads to, that, you know, going to a hospital is interpreted as sort of safer,
more superior,
you know, more advanced, or, you know, all of those kinds of, we saw a lot of that in agriculture where, you know, more farmers are turning towards using more chemical fertilizers and pesticides, you know, and so an organization that is committed to organic agriculture is fighting the occupation, and they're fighting sort of the temptations of development. And, you know, that I think that is goes kind of across the board for different sectors, you know, agricultural or women's issues all throughout Palestine. That's what I noticed.
I want to before the end of the show.
I can see you here talking or looking at each other about is an article or something, and you want to talk about that you've put out.
Yeah. Well, as we're talking of, we'll mention that in a second. But as we were talking about the resistance and talking about women.
Yeah.
And I really want to just sort of share our stories about how. I think I wasn't sure what to expect when I went into a nonviolent demonstration in the West Bank. And what we found was that in Budros, the village that we were staying in, the women were so important in that nonviolence resistance movement, and that they were actually out in the front leading the demonstrations, chanting, calling. The women were the ones in front of the soldiers, talking to them. Our good friend Iltizem, who is 15 years old, was in school when the village started to notice that olive trees were being destroyed. She and her classmates ran down to the olive grove, and she actually jumped into a bulldozer.
Did you say something on the air, or?
And so it's women together with men are leading the resistance movement, and it was such an honor to march together with women. It was beautiful.
Okay, we actually have a listener who is calling from Jerusalem with a comment.
Wow,
you're on the air. Can you hear us? Can you hear us, sir? Hello.
Hi. I could hear you over the web. I can't hear you on the phone.
Still there? Can you hear?
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear us now?
Yeah, that's great.
Good.
Okay. Let me just turn this down. First of all, let me just. I tuned in late. I heard what you were saying. Let me applaud. Let me report what you're reporting. It's really excellent work you're doing. But I just want to caution, I've been living here now for 4.5 years. I spend much of my time in a lot of the areas that you're talking about. I just want to caution against drawing the parallels too quickly and using the word apartheid in this case. And the reason is that many Palestinians, although they've adopted the language, feel somewhat that the situation is different as it was classically set up in South Africa. They feel that they're looking for a state, they're looking for their own identity, and that the occupation, as it seems, is an oppressive, I'm searching for the right word because I've lost so much of my English, but as an oppressive presence, as a roadblock to that, has caused them a good deal of... you're going to have to help me out a little bit because I know that you've experienced the same thing. Israelis feel outrage when they hear the word apartheid because they were so strongly against it and they had such strong ties with South Africa during that difficult time. As a matter of fact, one of the streets here was named after General Smuts was changed until apartheid was taken down. So I really want to caution against the use of that word. It doesn't help here. And people on both sides of the situation get rather outraged. What I also want to say is that some of the parallels that you've drawn, especially in Palestinian homes, as far as the lack of adults, male presence there, is absolutely right. And what you say about the parallel to the inner cities is exactly on target. It's really, really destroying the community within the Palestinian communities. I think what you're talking about is just great. I wish that I knew more of your presence because it could have aided some of the efforts that we're trying to do here. What program, can you just tell me what program you were working on again?
We, Hillary and I, this is Sarah, we worked with the International Solidarity Movement.
Right. How long were you, I'm sorry that I tuned in so late, how long were you there?
I was there 2.5 months, and Hillary was there a month. So I was mostly in the village of Budros on the Green Line.
Right, I got that. It's really excellent work. You're both students at Goddard?
No, we're farmers in Burlington,
sorry,
Vermont.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
No.
Please do come back again. We could use
Inshallah.
More.
We're planning on it. Thank you.
Inshallah.
Thanks so much for calling in. I want to say we're sharing our personal experience and what we observe directly. It's quite a topic to take on in discussion. There's so much history and really complexities and different sides. And, I really appreciate when people tune in with their own observations to help really round out the whole picture. And I really, thanks so much for calling
thank
and
you
listening.
So much for
thank
calling.
Thank you. And given the news of today and hearing what's going on in Gaza City, I mean, it's frustrating sitting on this side of the border. And hearing your voices and hearing the positive news that you had to deliver was so very good. Oh, congratulations
thank
and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Can
Bye-bye.
I just really quickly announce this booklet that Hillary and I wrote emails.
I'm going to hang up.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Bye. Hillary and I wrote emails, correspondence, and when we were in the West Bank and sent them back to our friends, and we have compiled them into a booklet called From the Olive Groves of Palestine, Vermont Farmers Write Home. And you can email me for a copy. We're asking for $5 suggested donation, and all of the proceeds are going to go to farmers that have been displaced by the wall or had their land confiscated. My email address is SRA@riseup.net. Again, that's SRA@riseup.net. And I would, one of the best websites I think available is Vermonters for a Just Peace. And that website is www.vtjp.org. Again, that's vtjp.org. You can also see our emails there and get updated news and information from Israel and Palestine.
Any last comments?
Another quick website. The ISM, International Solidarity Movement website, is PAL Solidarity. That's P-A-L Solidarity.org.
Mm-hmm.
And that could, if anyone out there is interested in doing a similar trip to what Sarah and I did and really going into the territories and joining that movement, that would be a good place to start your research.
Please contact us
because we are both very much interested in facilitating some more sort of Vermont presence over there and really continuing to raise the bar of discussion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just this Saturday at noon in Burlington, there's an anti-war demonstration and against occupation in Iraq and Palestine. That's going to be at noon this Saturday at the Unitarian Universalist Church at the top of Church Street.
Thank you so much, both of you, Hillary and Sarah, for joining us today here
in
the Quilting Hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I think we covered a number of issues, and we could go on
and on
and on and on. It's just very dear to my heart.